You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, enlightened, light-fast, light-hearted light bulbs. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 86. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your block rockers who squawk and talk about socks and rocks.
Oh. I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. We've covered socks and rocks, probably.
Yeah. Rocks, definitely.
Rocks, definitely. Yeah. Socks, maybe not. All right, Ooh, put okay. it down on the list.
All right,
socks.
Let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hot Shot. All right, you guys have your barnyard buzzers ready.
Indeed.
Yes.
And I picked a random card from the box, a random Trivial Pursuit card from the box. Here we go. Blue Wedge for geography. In the Lord of the Rings movies, what country stands in for Middle Earth? Oh, Dana, the expert.
New Zealand.
Yes.
Oh, correct. I get it. I didn't understand the question.
I didn't either. I thought
Me neither.
I didn't understand. It's a poorly worded question.
I thought it meant like it's a symbol of what country, like Middle Earth is like England.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Pink Wedge for pop culture. Which of these was not an enemy of the Enterprise on Star Trek?
Okay, was not an enemy.
Okay.
Okay.
There's three choices.
All right.
The Salt Vampire, the Goa Uld, or Tribbles. Chris.
The Goa.
Okay.
I'd heard of the Salt Vampire, as funny as that is. I didn't know if Tribbles were their enemy. I guess they were an enemy.
They're more of a nuisance than an enemy.
Yeah.
The Goa Uld, and they are evil parasitic creatures in the Stargate series.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Trick.
Huh. All right, Yellow Wedge. In 2000, what Family Values Republican married his third wife, a congressional aide, with whom he'd allegedly had an affair?
Was that Newt Gingrich?
Correct.
Yes.
Purple Wedge, what architect designed the Walt Disney Concert Hall, the Guggenheim Bilbao, and the Experience Music Project? Father of modern architecture.
That is Frank Gehry.
Correct. Yeah. Lots of shiny, squiggly things.
Yes.
If you think of architecture, it's shiny and it's squiggly, it's probably going to be Frank Gehry.
The Walt Disney Concert Hall was pretty shiny and squiggly for sure. Yeah.
Story checks out.
All right. Green Wedge for science. Giant pandas Hua Mei and Mei Sheng were born at what zoo? Colin.
Is that the National Zoo in Washington?
Incorrect. I think that's Taishan and somebody
else.
Another big zoo.
San Diego?
Correct.
All right.
Right. Last question. Orange Wedge, what culinary school dropout made the 2008 Forbes list of top celebrity chefs? 2008.
Oh, I actually didn't buzz, I don't think. Oh, I'm happy to guess.
Anthony Bourdain?
Incorrect.
No. Gordon Ramsay?
Incorrect.
Alton Brown?
2008. Emeril Lagasse?
Incorrect. It's funny that it's an orange wedge. It is Mario Batali, who wears orange clogs. All right. Good job, brains. So in previous episodes, we've taken you underground. We've taken you up in the air. And we've touched upon some stuff, but we never did a whole episode dedicated to water.
Really?
So we've talked about a lot. I mean, Chris, you talked about the mechanics of drowning.
We
talked about how I thought mermaids would mate, but never dedicated a whole episode to it. So this week, we're going to talk about the life aquatic.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sand and watches the ships that go sailing.
All right, well, you guys can smell the salt in the air. I have a nautical quiz I've put together for you here. So as you guys know, we get these in pub quiz, these nautical terms. And this is one of those realms, I think, where we all think we know what these terms are, but you press a little bit and then, I don't know, at least speaking for myself.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, let's probe here. Let's see.
Let's probe.
Let's talk about the parts of a ship.
All right.
Okay.
So, I mean, you guys know what the front and the back part of a ship are called? called?
I think so.
Fore yeah. and aft?
It's true in terms yeah. of direction. I'm talking about the bow and the stern.
Oh, okay.
So the bow is the front of the ship, and the stern is the back of the ship.
Okay. Did not know that. The bow is the front.
Yes, yeah. yes.
Maybe because it's arched like a bow. Maybe you can remember that way, like the bow.
Generally.
Stern like yeah. Ass.
Yeah, it's like a stern ass, butt, yeah. an angry... No, just like
that. I don't know. Angry butt, yeah. yeah. Right. the SS the angry butt. The
good, good first pass at these mnemonics.
yeah, yeah.
A little marinade.
We're think already off the rails. But yeah, have you ever heard the expression from stem to stern? You ever heard that before?
No.
Like,
yes.
Talk about something in its entirety, from mm-hmm. stem to stern. And that's a nautical expression. Mm-hmm. And so,
but what's the stem?
So the stem is the very, very front part of the bow, kind of the curve part, like you especially yeah. see it on like old wooden ships.
Right.
There's that one sort of beam that kind of curves up around the front.
Is that yep. where the yeah. naked lady sometimes is at?
She would be the attached in that okay. vicinity, yes.
You know, those pirate ships has those naked ladies.
Right. So the stem, the very front part, all the way to the back, the stern. So the whole ship, stem to stern.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So okay. good. We got that down. Do you guys, might know, what are the terms for left and right when you're aboard a ship?
What?
When you're aboard a ship.
Port and starboard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Port and
what's
starboard.
What?
Well, why didn't tell us there, Chris and Dan? Which is which? Which is which?
Port is left and starboard is right.
That's correct.
Okay.
Port is left. And you can just remember, the way I always remember, port is just four letters, left
yeah.
four letters. Do you know why starboard? Do you know where we get the word? It's starboard.
I like it.
Oh, it is a fun word.
It's not starboard.
Starboard.
Or starburst.
Oh. Okay, starburst.
Port and starburst.
Starboard.
Just starburst.
It's like it sounds like a kind of a lowbrow mixed with highbrow dessert, like yeah. some port and
port
a starburst.
Do you know where that comes from?
I do not.
Looking at the stars.
I think I always thought it was something, yeah, like mm-hmm. navigating by the stars.
Yeah.
I mean, so port is pretty straightforward. That's the side on which the ship affixes
so
to
port.
Port. The port, you know, it's on the left side of the ship.
Why?
It's forward.
Okay. It's just always like that.
Well, it's funny. It's connected to starboard. So the word actually. It comes from an old English word, stairboard, S-T-E-O-R, meaning steering. The same root as steering. This is the steering side of the ship.
Okay.
In older ships, the rudder would be just off the right side of the ship.
Okay.
It wasn't directly in line with the back of the boat.
Oh.
And the person would just steer the rudder, you know, and since most people were right-handed, they would stick the rudder, the theory goes, the rudder would be on the right side of the ship.
Oh.
So since the rudder's out there, you almost by necessity have to pull into port on the left side of the ship.
Hi.
So you can't damage the steering mechanism.
Wow, okay.
You know, up until, well into the 1800s, then they would use the term larboard for port, for the left side.
Okay.
So starboard and larboard.
Okay.
And you can
that's
see
like a cop show.
Sure.
That's
yeah.
a cop show.
That can get a little confusing, especially if you're in, you know, the heat of battle or something like
you're
that.
Yelling.
So
oh, sure. Yeah,
yeah. So eventually the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy adopted port and starboard, and those sort of became the
you
de facto.
Yell, you're like,
yeah.
all you hear is our board.
Yeah. Which
oh,
way
yeah.
am I
which
turning?
One did you
yeah.
say?
Well,
yeah.
It's natural selection, really.
What unit of measure do we use to measure how fast a ship is going?
Where's my buzzer?
Oh. Go ahead, buzzer. Karen.
Knot.
Yes, mm-hmm. it is a knot.
K-N-O-T.
And so here's a little tip just to note. It's not knots per hour. If you say
yeah.
a ship is traveling 30 knots per hour,
right,
that's incorrect.
A knot is a unit of measurement.
Speed.
It already has time
it's
in
distance,
it.
Distance and time.
Right. A knot is 1 nautical mile per hour.
Oh. Okay.
So a ship traveling 30 knots is traveling 30 nautical miles per hour.
Got it.
And a nautical mile is...
Yeah, what is a nautical mile?
It's a little bit longer than a standard mile.
Okay.
Why?
because old times.
Yeah.
Okay. Old times. That was not just short for nautical mile?
No. So this is
what?
Where it gets knots. This is one of those great, great, yeah. direct from its original use meaning words. So in the old days, before they had speedometers and GPS and fancy ways of tracking the speed of ship, they would have what was called a chip log. And what a chip log, originally it was an actual log, but more commonly it was a board. It was a wooden board that you would tie a rope to. You would toss the log or the board overboard. It has a rope attached to it,
uh-huh.
and tied into the rope at regular intervals are knots.
Okay.
And as the ship is moving,
oh.
the log or the board stays relatively stationary. It kind of catches the water. And then the operators, you kind of catch you count how many knots are running out through your hands over a given span of time.
Wow.
You know, so you got one guy's, you know, he's like, go, and start counts off 30 seconds, and you're like, okay, 20 knots. I counted out 20 knots, you know,
wow,
in this time
okay.
period. Right.
Yeah.
All right, last one here. What is the meaning of the phrase anchors away? If I say to you, anchors away, what does that connote? Or what do you...
Well, I know it's not A-W-A-Y.
Ah.
Right? Because that's what most people think is.
Yes.
Like, throw your anchors away. A-W-E-I-G-H. G-H.
That's right.
Yeah. And anchors away is like, we're leaving now. Like, we're pulling up the anchors and taking off.
It's really connected to pulling up the anchors. When you say the anchors away, mm-hmm. what that specific meaning is the anchor is hanging on the line, on mm-hmm. the chain. It's not connected to the bottom of the seabed or the floorbed. It's not fully back on the ship yet. Mm-hmm. And it kind of makes sense, because it's sort of, before you get going, you have to
move them
weigh
away.
Anchor, pull them up. Right, yeah. But no.
So weigh anchor is pulling it up, drop anchor is dropping it.
Yeah.
The bottom.
No. Yep. Oh. Yep. You guys know that classic anchor shape, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Traditional shape. It's got the sort of the crossbar and the main stem and then the two curved hook parts on the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are called flukes. This classic anchor shape is called the Admiralty pattern.
Oh.
And I learned in the course of doing some research, there are many, many, many different patterns and shapes and styles of anchors.
Okay.
And this just classic one dates
just
back.
Caught on.
Yeah, just really just visually has become sort of the shorthand for anchor.
Admiral letter T or like the state of
like
Admiralty.
Yeah, like the Admiralty. T-Y. Right, the right.
Oh,
exactly.
Admiralty.
Admiralty.
Not like
right.
Mr. T. Admiralty.
Yeah, yeah, not like Model T. Right?
Not like
yeah.
Mr. T. Not Mr. T joined the Navy and now commands a whole fleet of ships. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, hopefully that leaves us a little better prepared for our next nautical quiz.
So, you know the book 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
Yes.
Right? When they say 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the league is a unit of measurement.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Most people assume that means we started at sea level and then went down for 10,000 leagues, and this is what we found 10,000 leagues.
It's
no,
not that.
It's not that.
Yeah.
No, it's... We went under the sea, and then we traveled for 10,000 leagues.
Horizontally,
yeah. While we were underneath the sea.
Because can you go that deep into the ocean?
You cannot. You would die.
Yeah, so it really should be 10,000 leagues, comma.
While we were under the
while,
sea.
While under the sea.
Yeah.
The importance of comma.
Yeah, so when you find the book in your local library, remember to write a comma.
Perfect.
In Sharpie.
Yeah. Comma, under the sea.
And just tell them you're doing them a favor as they drag you away.
I also have more things to put in our trivia ammo.
Mm.
In prepping for pub trivia, we got a lot of geography questions and definitely bodies of water show up. So I'm going to share with all of you guys some mnemonics I myself made up. I won't say that they're super good, but it's just how I remember it.
Yeah.
So you can use it or not, or you can be like, that's horrible. But you know what? It helps me remember something.
These are free mnemonics, people. Yeah. Stop complaining.
Where else do you get free mnemonics?
Yeah, free mnemonics. Get your free mnemonics. All right. So the first one are the longest rivers.
Okay.
The three longest rivers. How I remember is, nay, these rivers are the longest. N-A-Y, Nile,
Amazon. Yangtze.
Yes, Yangtze.
Okay. I believe these are the longest rivers.
Nay.
These rivers are the longest.
These rivers are the longest.
That's in order from longest to Nile's the longest.
Top three. Top three.
Great.
Okay, we've talked about this before. Which ocean is the saltiest?
Oh, that's right. You did talk about it. It's because it evaporates. The Pacific.
Dana's right. It's Atlantic. And this is not a very good mnemonic, but hey, it helps you remember. I remember it by Salty Alty.
That's good.
Atlantic.
Almost.
You know,
yeah.
Almost.
But good. So close.
But Salty Alty.
Salty Alty.
Okay. It's kind of like a nickname. Yeah. Salty Alty. All right. One of the things I have the most trouble with is identifying which one's Black Sea and which one's Red Sea. So the Black Sea is located above the country Turkey.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, Turkey's bodies are mostly black.
Oh,
that
really?
That is the Black Sea.
Oh, yeah.
And Red Sea is where Somalia and the Gulf of Aden is, where all the Somalian pirates are. So that's the Red Sea, because there's violence there.
Oh, jeez.
A little dark. But Black Sea, Turkey's, yeah. This showed up on Pub Trivia a couple times. It is the body of water that's north of the French and Spanish coast. It's called the Bay of Biscay.
Mm. Oh,
and I remember it as the Bay of Biscuits.
Yeah.
French cookies, biscuits, I don't know. And the largest sea. Do you guys know what the largest sea is?
The largest
Mediterranean,
sea.
Caribbean?
Caribbean is number two, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Largest sea is South China Sea.
Really?
Oh. Yes. And largest sea, S-E-A, think of it as a letter, C, a big C, China, China Sea. So then here's the top four largest lakes in the world.
Okay.
And this is how I remember it. Some very huge mill ponds.
Okay.
Some very huge mill ponds, right, is like a little pond by
so,
like a
Superior? Vancouver? Lake Vancouver? Is that a place?
It's the largest in Africa.
Oh, Victoria.
Oh, Victoria.
Yeah, Lake Victoria. Okay.
Lake Victoria.
Mm-hmm. H.
Huron.
Correct.
Oh.
And last one.
Michigan?
Some very huge. Mm-hmm. Lake Michigan.
Okay.
Okay. Yep.
So it's some very huge mill ponds, Superior, Victoria, Huron, and Michigan.
Huh.
So Victoria is the largest lake in Africa. Michigan is the largest lake within one country.
All
of it is in one country. Huh. Like Superior and Huron, the borders with Canada.
Yeah.
Okay. But Michigan is entirely in one country. So that's something interesting to remember. Okay. So there you go. There are some mnemonics. You have a salty alty. You have nay.
That's good.
Yeah.
Rivers are the longest. Black turkeys and red pirates.
Maybe that's the weakest.
Yeah.
Of all.
Bay of biscuits, not that great either.
True. Yeah. Bay of biscuits is also confusing.
Yeah.
And some very huge mill ponds, largest lakes.
Some very huge mill ponds.
Some very huge mill ponds.
Yeah.
How do you spell Biscayne? Is it B-I-S-C-A-Y-N-E?
B-I-S-C-A-Y. Biscay.
Oh, Biscay.
Yeah.
It sounds French and Spanish.
Yeah. Biscay.
Biscay.
But as they say it in French.
Biscuit.
You want a biscuit? I don't speak French, by the way. I'm just a talented word guesser.
I'm a talented word guesser, I would say, is my greatest strength.
On your resume.
Oh,
put that on my LinkedIn.
Ma'am, I just wanted to know if you wanted fries with that. I don't.
French freeze.
I didn't say I was accurate. I just said I'm good at guessing. Yeah, I can generate a lot of guesses.
I really can. So I found out something interesting about our oceans. There's a thing called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a.k.a. the Pacific Trash Vortex.
What? Trash Vortex.
This is where the garbage pail kids come from?
From the trash vortex. Yeah. There's a massive area in the Pacific. And the reason why I'm being vague about and saying massive is because we're not really sure how big it is exactly.
Right.
It is a massive collection of the world's garbage floating around in the ocean.
Okay.
Infused throughout the water in this area.
Whoa. They're all kind of clusters.
There's this thing called the North Pacific Subtropical Gyre, which is basically the ocean currents swirling where they kind of converge. It swirls around, and a lot of plastic ends up over there.
And so anything that ends up in the ocean at some point, the currents just sort of carry it to one centralized.
Yeah. It gets to there and it just swirls around and it just hangs out. The water over there is full of plastic pieces because a lot of plastic doesn't biodegrade.
Right.
It won't break down into smaller compounds. It just gets smaller. So it's photodegrading.
Mm.
This becomes like confetti in the water, whole water. And you can't actually see this garbage patch from satellite because it's just the whole water is full of plastic pieces. And they call them nurdles or mermaid tears, which sounds
We've had nurdle.
Yeah.
On this show as like a little bit of something, right? Like that's what it is. Like you put a nurdle of toothpaste on your toothbrush, right?
Yes, but they call them also mermaid tears.
Mermaid tears.
And I watched this documentary where people went diving in there and they came out and they were covered in, it looked like glitter, but it was all just little pieces of plastic all over their bodies.
So it's like a swirling column of trash?
Yes.
Confetti trash.
Mm.
Degraded plastic.
Photodegraded nurdles.
Whoa.
Yeah, mermaid tears.
Degraded nurdles.
Yeah.
Like, roughly how big, across are we talking? Like, is this...
So, I've seen things that were like, it's as big as Texas. It's twice as big as Texas. It's, you know, like, it's really hard to measure how big it is because you can't see where the borders are. It's just...
Okay, all right. It's not like...
It's like, all of this water is garbage water.
Wow.
Like, very few things can live here.
I think I was picturing something like the size of a backyard swimming pool or something, but not the size of a state. That is...
That's so sad.
It's sad. The mermaids cried there.
Oh.
Well, I have a happier story about mermaids.
Yay.
I figured if we were going under the sea, we should certainly talk about The Little Mermaid, the famous 1989 Disney film, The Little Mermaid. So originally it was a fairy tale by
Hans Christian Andersen.
Yes, writer of such other fairy tales as Thumbelina. And he wrote it in 1837. Been a little recap. So it's actually pretty close. She is a mermaid princess. She has a bunch of sisters. Mm-hmm. She does surface above the water and she sees a prince and the prince gets into a shipwreck and she rescues him and she gets him back to shore and she goes back to the sea and she meets up with the sea witch who trades her voice, her beautiful singing voice for pair of legs. Mm-hmm. Now it starts splitting off a little bit because there's a little bit more at stake. So in the Hans Christian Andersen story, walking on her legs feels like walking on broken glass, he describes it as. And the prince loves to see her dance. And so she dances for him, even though it hurts worse than walking.
He just likes the look on her face.
That's so messed up.
Curse basically is still the same. If she doesn't get a kiss from the prince, she doesn't get her voice back, etc. Mm. But also, if he marries another woman, she will die.
Mm.
So guess what? Prince marries another woman.
Yeah.
And her sisters show up with a magical knife that they got from the sea witch, and they said, "It's all good. Take this knife and murder him in his sleep before the next day dawns and you won't die."
Oh,
so she's like, sounds good. So she takes the knife in and she has to kill the prince and his wife, but she backs out and decides she can't do it. And she throws herself into the sea as dawn breaks and she turns into sea foam and dies. And the end of the story is she gets to go to heaven. So do you guys know in what decade the Walt Disney Company first started working on The Little Mermaid?
Just by the way you asked that, I know it's going to be old.
1970.
Earlier.
Whoa!
50s. Yes.
Earlier.
Wow. Really? Was Disney himself still alive?
It was the end of the 1930s.
Wow.
Right after they finished Snow White. They started shopping Little Mermaid and other Hans Christian Andersen stories.
Yeah.
And they did concept artwork and stuff. And then it just sort of, they didn't really do it and they just worked on other stuff instead.
Wow.
But they had batted around Little Mermaid.
End of the 30s.
I want to see the 1930s.
Into the early
40s. Mermaid art.
Wow, yeah.
Yep.
50 years in the making, kind of.
When they started up in the 1980s, they picked up the idea again. The people working at Disney at that time didn't know that Disney had done some preliminary work in the 30s, but they found it in the archives. There was a Disney illustrator named Kay Nielsen, whose work had been used for the Ave Maria and the Night on Bald Mountain sections of Fantasia.
Yeah.
It's really striking visual work. You seem to know something about Kay Nielsen.
His stuff is beautiful.
Okay.
I have a ton of his books. I didn't know that he worked on The Little Mermaid. Though.
Yeah, he had done some concept art for Little Mermaid, and this was inspirational to the 80s crew, and he actually got a posthumous credit in The Little Mermaid
for
visual development artist. There is, and I was really interested to find this out, because I know this movie, there is another 1980s mermaid movie whose existence had an impact on how The Little Mermaid shook out.
Oh,
It is Splash!
Yeah.
Starring Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah.
Yes.
That was also
and
formative.
Eugene Levy and John Candy.
And John Candy.
Yeah. Do you know what's interesting about that movie? Like what famous first Splash is?
Famous. Was that the first Ron Howard directed film?
It wasn't the first Ron Howard directed film. It was the first film released by Touchstone Pictures, which was Disney's brand. Disney nearly did not make The Little Mermaid because they had a big hit with Splash, and they felt it was maybe too similar. And so that's why it kind of got put off in the early 80s, but then by the late 80s, they were ready to come back to it. Anyway, Ariel from The Little Mermaid was made a redhead so she would not look too much like long-haired Daryl Hannah.
Madison.
They looked at the astronaut Sally Ride's hair in space as a way of figuring out how to draw
how
her hair underwater.
I thought they modeled her after Sally Ride.
They modeled her after Sally Ride. No, they did model her after Alyssa Milano.
Really?
At the time was the child actress on Who's the Boss. Yeah, they drew her like Alyssa Milano. What Disney ended up doing, the pivotal decision that they made, is they hired Howard Ashman, who was a playwright and lyricist, who came along with his working partner, Alan Menken, the musician. Now, do you know what these two guys did right before Little Mermaid? what they worked on together?
They were on a Broadway musical.
Yes.
Right? Oh man.
It was 1980s. It was a Broadway musical that had a very successful film version in the middle of the 80s.
It's too late for
that.
Grease.
Ashman and Mankin worked on.
Oh, Newsies.
It's not Newsies. No, that was later, and that was not a success. No, it was Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh.
Ashman and Mankin were Little Shop of Horrors, and so they bring in Howard Ashman, and he didn't just like write the lyrics to the songs. Like, he came in as like a sort of an, he was a producer on Little Mermaid, mm-hmm. and came in and was like, let's structure this movie like a Broadway
yeah.
musical.
Yeah.
That was the creative reboot for them. It was like, let's structure this like a Broadway musical and like, you know, have the songs be the sort of major kind of story beats.
Yeah.
You know? Yep, yep, yep. So here's some other bits of trivia that explain, you know, more elements of how did they get it turned around. Well, there's something else that I can definitely mention, which is, so the woman who was the speaking and singing voice of Ariel was an yeah. actress named Jodie Benson.
Yes!
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she, and I mean, obviously she was fantastic, but there is actually somebody else that we can credit for bringing Ariel to life. Her name is Sherry Lynn Stoner. She was a member of the Groundlings, the improv mm. comedy
in
group
LA.
In LA, yeah. which also included Paul mm. Rubens, Sherry O'Terry, Pat Morita, mm. Mr. Miyagi was in the Groundlings.
Really?
True story, yeah.
Oh.
Disney, with The Little Mermaid, went back to something that they used to do back when they did movies like Snow White. They shot live action reference footage. So basically they take actors and bring them in and have them act out all the scenes. And so Sherry Lynn Stoner was the actress that did Ariel. But if you go back and you look at this footage, which is on, I think, the more recent like Blu-ray that they did, she is improvising all the mannerisms of Ariel mm. that made it into the movie. When Ariel blows yeah. her hair out of her eyes, all of her really quirky physical mannerisms, it's all being acted out by Sherry Stoner, its actress. So, like, that's
wow.
why that character is so kind of human. Yeah. And one final thing. The Little Mermaid was the first of the Disney movies to use Pixar technology.
Ah.
There was one scene at the very end of The Little Mermaid when they sail off together, Ariel and the prince, and there's a transparent rainbow.
Yeah.
That is done with computers. But you might have been thinking, Karen, is that Beauty and the Beast actually used a computer rendered.
I thought the first one was Aladdin with the magic carpet.
Oh,
that
no.
was the first, I thought that was the first time like a computer animated thing showed on screen.
No, Beauty and the Beast, the ballroom.
Right.
The ballroom
oh,
when they're dancing, that ballroom
right.
is CG.
That's yeah.
the whole
that's
thing.
Yeah, you
that's
look at
even,
it, the animation and the perspective yep. is just looks perfect when
yeah.
they're, yeah.
yeah.
You think if mermaids poop, it would be like fish poop, like
they,
it's like a string. It's like a
long string. It just trails out. Yeah.
Like shrimp veins.
So gross. Ariel like looks different.
Right, right, right.
All right, let's take a quick ad break. A word from our sponsor.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Calling all kids in the car. Brittany and Meredith here from the chart-topping Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Are you dreading another silent car ride with the fam? We've got the cure. 3 rounds of fresh trivia every single week. Movies, music, even science and Disney. We've got something for every trivia buff in the car. No more crickets chirping on those long journeys. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast is your secret weapon for connecting and laughing with kids of all ages, teens, toddlers, adults, it doesn't matter. Spark their curiosity and challenge their brains with every episode. New episodes drop weekly wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast and turn those car rides into epic adventures.
And we're back. You're listening to Good Job Brain, and this week we're talking about things under the sea, or ocean, or other, or water in general.
So I'm not a big, in general, a really big naval history guy or military buff, but I've always been fascinated by submarines. It fascinates me because it's this self-contained world. I think it's why I was always interested in spaceships too. I feel like, submarines are more like spaceships than, you know, regular
Sure, sure, sure. Because you can't just get out.
Yeah, right. you can't just get out. You've got to be the self-contained world and
just surrounded by danger.
I mean, and just all the crazy engineering challenges that you have to solve to have a viable submarine. Mm-hmm. And it's water pressure and people have to be able to breathe and it can't, you know, it's got to be able to steer around underwater. I don't know. We were lucky enough to have a friend who worked, aboard the Pampanito, which is the World War II era submarine that they have docked here in San Francisco in Fisherman's Wharf. The first thing that struck me is just, it is so claustrophobic in there. It is so tight in there. And I mean, granted, this is World War II era. They're a little bit bigger, more spacious now, but a submarine is not a spacious place. It is, you really need to be comfortable in close quarters, not just contained in, but packed in with other people.
Right. So you know? Suspicions confirmed.
I mean, they have, you know, they call, do you guys know what a hot bunk is? Have you heard that term before?
It sounds like a mean thing you do to your little brother or sister.
Hot bunked at sleepaway camp.
Yeah. Fart.
Hot box.
No, a hot bunk is like on submarines, the space is so tight that the crew works in shifts and they don't have beds that are empty. They don't have room on a sub. So you, when they change shifts, that's when you go to sleep. And so when I'm going to bed, there's some other guy who's just gotten up before me because he's on shift now and I'm coming off shift. So I get in the bunk. It's already warm. It's hot. It's a hot bunk.
It's unsettling.
Yeah, I imagine.
It's like when you sit in a toilet seat and it's warm. And it's like, this is nice, but at the same time, it's like, I know where this came from.
The history of subs, it's interesting because you have to start talking about the difference between submersibles and submarines. You know, so there are a lot of things in history that are sort of like diving bells, glorified diving bells, basically, where it's, you can sort of get below the surface of the water and look around and you have a limited amount of air, but you can't drive it around. It's not really self-sufficient. It can't last anyway. Kind of like a bell or a bowl almost that you would get a person inside in there and you lower it very carefully below the water and it maintains a pocket of air.
Or lower it not carefully at all, depending on if you like them.
You know, there's sort of some criteria that make a true submarine. Like it's basically
you have to stay alive when you're in it.
That's, you know what? I mean, it's funny to say that, but that's number one. Part of it is it needs to have some degree of self-sufficiency.
I'll send you down as far as you want.
Some degree of self-sufficiency, some amount of oxygen, some way of controlling buoyancy is really important, that you can control how far below the water you go and whether it's weights or pumped air, pumped water, and then the ability to navigate underwater. Like, these are sort of the hallmarks of a real sub. Now, I mean, this is not going to surprise you that military goals really push along development. That's like, oh, wait, we can use this in warfare. We can use this to battle. And it was the American Revolutionary War where the first modern workable submarine.
Wait,
really?
Yeah. 1776.
1776.
In the war?
It was used in the war effort. And this is amazing. Yes, it is the Turtle, nicknamed the Turtle.
It's not very heroic.
Well, you know, I mean, it was more descriptive. It was actually, they say, I mean, it looked more like a clam than a turtle, but it was sort of named after after what it looked like. It was tiny, first of all. It was made to hold one person. Okay. And it was like two wooden kind of clamshell halves fused together. It was constructed, you know, not unlike a barrel. I mean, it was staves of wood, lots of tar, steel bands, hold it together, make it watertight. Right. And
now, was this used by the British against the rebellious colonies?
No, this was used by the good guys. This was used by the...
We draw a line in the sand.
I guess so. We don't take a lot of sides here, Colin.
No, it was invented by a guy named David Bushnell, who was a freshman at Yale when he started developing this. It really kind of puts me to shame. I was thinking what I was doing my freshman year of college. I was not developing submarines, that's for sure.
He made a barrel.
And a clam barrel.
He was working on two things sort of simultaneously. He was working on underwater explosives, and then he also developed the Turtle. And they got General George Washington to agree to use the Turtle in an actual battle.
Wow.
So now, again, like, when I say submarine, you might be thinking of like Hunt for Red October. All right. This thing was, it was like 10 feet by 6 feet by 3 feet. Like, it was one person. It was all hand crank powered, like the propulsion, the valves, the pumps, everything was hand powered.
Okay.
It only had enough oxygen in there for about 30 minutes. science underwater.
Oh, okay, all right.
So yeah, this was, you know, it's early era. Okay.
But nobody was expecting it.
That's right.
Nobody was looking for the turtle.
Now, as you can imagine, like we talked about, you got to be able to breathe, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got to be able to drive the thing. It was hand-powered. What's the other thing you need to be able to do when you're in a dark vessel underneath the water?
See?
You need to be able to see.
Yes.
All right, so they didn't have electric lamps down there that you can't be burning candles, obviously, because it's going to burn up your oxygen.
Yep.
They used foxfire. Do you know what this is? This is bioluminescent fungus.
Oh. Yes. From the forests and stuff.
This was the source of lighting in the turtle, the submarine. They had a chunk of cork basically that was covered with foxfire, and that was what lit the inside of the turtle.
God,
was this
so
greenish
awesome.
This greenish bluish bioluminescent fungus.
Now I love it. This is awesome.
It's like a Game of
Thrones
thing.
It's so nature-y. It's like made by a badger. That's
But yeah, you can imagine this in a movie. Or
like
in Bioshock. It's
Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. That's his submarine.
Yeah, exactly. Really just kind of creepy light. So by 1776, George Washington was like, yep, we're ready to use this. So they were using it in defense of New York Harbor. And the plan was to send it to attack the HMS Eagle. And so they towed it in as close as they could get it. Like, it wasn't fast. Like, I remember his hand crank operated. Yeah, it went like 3 miles an hour.
There's only 30 minutes of air.
30 minutes of air. Yeah. So they would tow it out and then get as close as they could before it would submerge and go, you know, sneak up and attack. So I mentioned that David Bushnell was working on underwater explosives, right?
Okay.
So the plan was the turtle would go underwater, sneak up to the ships, attach a time bomb, essentially.
It's like a barnacle.
Secret
barnacle.
Like with an elaborate clockwork mechanism that could continue to work underwater with Bushnell's water-safe explosives.
And it'd crank away.
And then it would like swim away, right? As far away as it could, and then it would blow up.
Yeah.
So it was sent to attack the HMS Eagle, a volunteer from the army. He made a couple attempts to attach it. He was not successful. And it's a little unclear why. He couldn't get it stuck onto the hull. He may have encountered like iron plates. So he had to flee. And as he was fleeing, you know, he reported that he was spotted. So he detached the explosive and just kind of just fled away.
Yeah.
And his thinking was like, oh, maybe they'll take the explosive in and it'll blow up on board the ship.
It didn't.
It exploded in the harbor. Apparently it was quite spectacular by all accounts.
Oh, so it works.
It didn't take the ship down, so it was technically an unsuccessful attack. Yes, the explosion did go off. They did run the turtle on at least another mission or two. It never did succeed in sinking a ship directly.
Wow.
Okay.
So, yeah, I encourage you to go look up pictures of the turtle, the first sort of modern submarine.
It does.
It looks
like an acorn. It's like an underwater acorn.
It does. Yeah, that's a really good description. It does look like an acorn. Yep.
Wow.
Neat idea.
So for this episode, I wanted to explore aquariums. Like, you know, we have like fish tanks and stuff like that. And it kind of took me to a very strange world. So I want to tell you guys a story. Half of it is hypothetical.
Okay.
Half of it is based on true events. And so this is kind of based on a TV show segment I watched from a TV show called Life After People, which used to be on the History Channel. I don't think it's...
Yeah.
I guess now it's on the internet. fantastic show. Basically, the premise of the show is what happens when all of a sudden, every human person just disappears. What will happen to our world?
Mm-hmm.
The world that we would leave behind. One of the things that they talked about in the show is what will happen to aquariums if humans are not involved in maintaining it, and what will happen to all those animals and to the whole facility and the whole system. As we know, like in a lot of the big aquariums or research institutes, it's very heavily monitored by humans, right?
Yep.
So I'm just going to run you through a hypothetical situation. This is what will probably happen. And it's a little bit dark, but stay with me.
Okay.
Stay with me. So first of all, no humans means probably the first thing to go is electricity. So no electricity. Most aquariums will have an emergency generator that will last a week. No electricity means that the pipes in the system will stop piping in oxygen, will probably stop removing the waste, and basically all of your water will be filled with ammonium, which is from fish poo. And fish pee. And so the fish in the water, ammonium poison water, will start taking in ammonium and they'll die because it's poisonous to their bodies. Mm-hmm. The next thing is the temperature is going to rise up because there's no AC. Mm-hmm. There's no one controlling the actual air that's in the facility. So it's going to get really, really hot. And then the water is going to get really, really hot. Then you have more fish dying. And even though I'm describing a hypothetical situation, this segment on the show, Life After People, is kind of based on what actually happened to an aquarium in America. This is when Hurricane Katrina attacked. This is what happened to the Audubon Aquarium of Americas in New Orleans. Massive, massive storm that happened in the States 8 years ago, right? 8 years ago. And what happened was people were being evacuated. Actually, some heroes, I would call them heroes, who worked at the aquarium stayed inside the aquarium. Mm. And they actually had a lot of police officers who kind of set up camp and helped feed the animals, helped maintain the animals during this horrific storm. At one point, they all had to evacuate. Yeah. They all had to evacuate. Mm-hmm. So the aquarium was left for 4 days.
Okay.
With no human involvement. The staff came back after 4 days.
Yeah.
And there was still no electricity. And the first thing they said when they walked in was it smelled like dead fish.
Oh,
it was dark. For only 4 days, the surface of the water was already covered with dead fish, dead animals, from little fish to like sharks.
Yeah.
And the temperature of the water was warm, and water was so cloudy, they had flashlights. The flashlight could only penetrate like an inch.
Oh my God.
Just so four days, and like that's how,
animals did survive this. And they're all animals who breathed air, who would come up to the surface. Yep. So there's the tarpon, which is a fish that would come up on the surface and gulp air and then go back in the water. So a lot of the birds, a lot of otters, penguins, alligators, they all survived.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually were airlifted to other aquariums as a safe house or other facilities throughout the nation. So they're airlifted and help these animals. And it's kind of sad.
Oh, that's once they got back in there?
Yeah. And it's kind of sad because a lot of the animals that died were either really rare species or, I mean, it's a conservation center. It's very heartbreaking. Another hypothetical situation. If this happened for a whole year.
Yep.
This is only 4 days. If this happened for a year, only one animal would survive.
Oh.
And that would be the alligator.
Really?
Yeah, because the alligator can reduce its heart rate. Yeah, it reduces its metabolism to 1 to 2 beats per minute.
Wow. That is amazing.
Yeah, but I mean, after a year, like, the
eventually,
almost done.
Yeah.
That's a long time without food.
Dang.
It was a crazy alligator. So yeah, on the happier note, the aquarium had to restock a lot of the animals, and a lot of other aquariums in the nation donated. So like the Tennessee Aquarium, Chattanooga, donated catfish, like shark pups. And
you know, I'm imagining like a big barrel, you know, like a animal life drive, like throw some otters in. I've got some spare catfish. We'll put them in the barrel.
4 days.
Just 4 days. All right, and we have one more quiz segment. Dana, are you grace us with a le quiz?
As they say. As I guess they say.
In French, right? Maybe. All right, so this is just a random grab bag of sea and sea-related trivia. Get your buzzers ready.
Yeah.
So we'll kick it off with our good old friend SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah, man.
He lives under the sea. Where under the sea does he make his home? What atoll?
I believe it's Bikini Bottom.
Yes, the Bikini Atoll, and he's at the bottom of the Bikini. So Bikini Bottom, yes. All right, so the Bikini...
That's edgy. Edgy for a kid's
It's funny. The Bikini Atoll is part of what island group?
God, we talked about this, too.
Oh, yeah, we have.
Because it was where they did some nuclear testing.
That's right,
I think it was part of, like, it was owned by, maybe part of... France.
Yeah.
No. What's the island group?
Island group. I can't retrieve it.
It's the Marshall Islands.
Marshall Islands.
So SpongeBob's best friend is a starfish. What's the average lifespan of a starfish?
What's his
Is it 1 year, 5 year, 35 years, or 50 years? Chris?
50 years.
No.
Dang.
It is 35 years.
Yeah. So a long time.
That's still pretty long.
Yeah. In Lewis Carroll's poem, The Walrus and the Carpenter, trick what type of sea life to walk along the beach with them? Everybody.
Oysters.
Bonus. Who recited the poem to Alice in Through the Looking Glass? Karen?
The caterpillar.
Nope.
Was it the mock turtle?
Nope. Mm.
The dodo bird?
No, it was Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Oh, yes, that's yeah. right. Oh, jeez.
Whoa.
Yeah, no, I moved my barnyard buzzer.
So intense. Was the Pirates of the Caribbean theme song written by Disney or not Disney?
Oh.
Karen.
Oh, the original Yo-Ho, Yo-Ho?
Yeah.
Written by Disney.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was written for the ride, but it was based on a shanty by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Oh.
Oh. Huh. Isn't he a writer?
Yeah.
Not Treasure Planet.
Treasure Island. Treasure Island.
Planet Island. It's all the same thing.
Yes. What three-word idiom is used as a euphemism for the bottom of the ocean?
Is that Davy Jones' locker?
Yes.
Oh. That's what it means?
Yeah.
Not just the squid guy's treasure?
No, yes. That's right.
Oh, send you down to Davy Jones' locker. You don't want to go there.
That makes so much more sense now.
St. Elmo's Fire was named for St. Erasmus, the patron saint of sailors.
Hmm. Okay.
What is St. Elmo's Fire?
Isn't it's a natural occurrence.
Isn't it related to, it's like some sort of off-gassing or something,
it's
right?
Like
that produces bioluminescent.
It's a weather phenomenon. So the technical way you would say it is, it's a weather phenomenon in which luminous plasma is created by coronal discharge from a sharp or pointed object in a strong electrical field in the atmosphere. Basically, it looks like there's a glowing ball of light around like a lightning rod or a ship's mast or something like that. So sailors would be out in a thunderstorm and the top of their mast would have this big ball of light. And they would be like, oh, it's St. Elmo's fire. Hmm. He's blessing us. What is baleen?
Baleen.
I know you've heard this word before.
It has to do with whales.
Uh-huh. Baleen.
The baleen.
Baleen whales.
Yeah. Is it the filter that the whales use to filter out
the
krill?
Filter. Okay. Yes.
Oh.
Good job.
Oh,
yeah. The brushy thing.
The brushy stuff. Like the car wash mouth.
Yes.
Oh,
good job.
Whales got car wash mouth?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a highly technical term, Chris.
Yeah.
Car wash mouth.
All right, last question. This is kind of funny. According to 10,000boatnames.com, okay, as of today, they actually had 26,000 boat names. What is the most popular sailboat name?
Oh, geez.
And I'll give you a hint.
Oh, wow.
It's a pun on wind. Kind of a pun.
I hope it's not like breaking wind
but that would be funny.
Legs of breeze.
That's good. That's good.
It's not bad.
What is it?
Second Wind.
Second Wind is the most popular sailboat name?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's
kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. And that's our underwater show.
We didn't tape it underwater.
That would be really weird.
Our homemade submarine.
That would be cool.
In our turtles.
Have you seen them making
Lisa
a hotel
turtle.
That's underwater and your room is like in a tube, a glass tube?
I will freak out.
No, thank you.
I was like, that sounds amazing.
I would stay there. I think that sounds cool.
I would check it out.
That is
Instagram
cool.
some stuff and then go up on the surface and be
okay,
like,
here's your room. You have 30 minutes of oxygen and good night.
We call it the turtle.
I'm sorry. Where's the light switch? Oh, here's your foxfire.
Yeah, I know.
Good night.
Complimentary foxfire.
Smells like...
Double Tree gives me cookies.
Well, thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learn a lot about turtle, submarines, Little Mermaid, baleen, mnemonics. And you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And check out our sponsor at audiblepodcast.com/goodjobbrain. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Traffic jams. Tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.